to meeting number two of the Mises Academy class on big business and the free market. We are discussing whether these things are friends or foes. On Tuesday night, Peter talked about the nature of the firm, and tonight I'm going to talk about the nature of the state. So very, very interesting. Peter mentioned Ronald Coase the other night, and Coase actually celebrated his 101st birthday today. So Coase, and he's actually still active. Within the last year or two, he's published a book. So while we're thinking about this, Coase made a lot of really important contributions to our understanding of transactions, our understanding of hierarchies, our understanding of firms, and our understanding of states. Peter was a student at the University of California at Berkeley of Oliver Williamson, who won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for his work on the nature of economic organization, primarily as it concerns firms. And one of my mentors in graduate school, Douglas North, who we'll talk about in a minute, won the Nobel Prize in the early 1990s for his work on the nature of economic organization, primarily as it relates to states. So neither Peter or I is Williamson or North, but we are close enough substitutes for our purposes. And yes, in fact, I'm ripping off a joke that Peter made about that some number of years ago when I gave a guest lecture at the University of Missouri while I myself was still a graduate student. Okay. So with that, we want to ask what exactly we're doing tonight. How are we making this transition from the firm to the state? And then what are we going to do next week when we talk about the relationship between power and market, and when we talk about specifically the rise of big box retail and changes in the American economy in the late 20th century? Well, these are interesting times that we live in. You are probably familiar with the Occupy movement. So people are occupying Wall Street. They're occupying, in some cases, they're occupying ports in places like Oakland. They're occupying various cities, occupying various avenues, various boulevards, various whatevers. And in the process, sort of forcing the conversation about the nature of modern American capitalism, or the nature of economic growth, or the nature of how societies themselves are organized. I agree with the Occupy movement that there's a lot to be angry about, and specifically, we're in the process of playing a game that's rigged in the favor of some powerful special interests. I don't necessarily know that it's capitalism that's to blame. I don't necessarily know that it's the profit motive as such that's to blame, and I think what we need to do is take a much harder look at the relationship between the state and the market, and a much harder look at the nature of the state itself. And that, in large part, is what we're going to do tonight. So I mentioned Doug North a second ago. In 1981, North published a book called Structure and Change in Economic History. And in it, he tried to interpret most of economic history in light of basically simple, straightforward neoclassical economics. And North made the following argument in his chapter in which he laid out a neoclassical model of the state. He said, and I quote, "The existence of a state is essential for economic growth. The state, however, is the source of man-made economic decline. This paradox should make the study of the state central to economic history. Models of the state should be an explicit part of any analysis of secular changes." So for a very long time, people thought that there was a disconnect between production and distribution. So production is primarily an economic issue. Distribution is primarily a political issue, never the twain shall meet. What we've noticed, and one of the things that North brought into the conversation, is that the state and the firms that are operating under the power of the state are definitely relevant for determining, first of all, how much production takes place, and then second, how that production gets distributed. So here's where we're going tonight. We're going to do a handful of things. First of all, we're going to talk about what states actually are. Okay? And we're going to talk about different kinds of hierarchies. There are voluntary hierarchies, there are involuntary hierarchies, and they have different properties. We're going to talk about a little bit what we mean by big government. So people criticize big government, and it's not always clear necessarily what we mean by big government, in the same way that it's not always clear that we know exactly what we mean when we're talking about big business. We're going to talk about incentives and institutions. We'll talk about what institutions are, how they frame incentives, how they determine incentives. We'll talk about the kind of society that you want to create. And we'll wrap up by talking about what all of this can tell us about the possibility of civilization, not just the structure of civilization, but the very possibility of civilized interaction between people. So with that, let's talk about what a state is. Okay, so Murray Rothbard, in the early 1960s, published his magnum opus, or his grand treatise called Man, Economy, and State. And I think this is appropriate for a couple of different reasons. These are all sort of analytically distinct categories. Men act in an economic system. They make one another better off. They act, they seek to achieve goals, and they can achieve those goals by making one another better off in an economic system, by helping other people achieve their own goals. In the context of a state, things are a little bit more difficult, or things are not quite as straightforward, or not quite as clear. In the context of a state action, people achieve their goals by restricting the ability of others to achieve their own. So let's think about what a state actually is. What is a state? What is a government? So here's how North defines it. According to North, a state is an organization with a comparative advantage in violence, extending over a geographic area whose boundaries are determined by its power to tax constituents. Rothbard and a lot of others also add to this, or would summarize this as saying that a state is a monopolist on force over a particular geographic area. So what's the key characteristic of a state? What's the thing that distinguishes a state from a firm? States are firm-like in some respects. States are economic actors. States are primarily and fundamentally political actors. But what are the things that separate states from other types of economic organizations? Notice the key word in North's definition is violence. The difference between a state and a firm is that the state uses violence. Firms do not. Firms might get the state to use violence on their behalf, but the fundamental difference between a commercial transaction and a political transaction is the use of violence. In a commercial transaction, one uses persuasion. In a political transaction, one uses coercion, as I mentioned a moment ago. In a commercial transaction, or in a commercial society, if you want to achieve your own goals, the way to do this is to help other people achieve theirs. In a political society, in a political transaction, if you want to achieve certain goals, the way you do that is by preventing other people from achieving their own goals, from achieving their own ends. So when we're talking about a state, we're talking about an organization that has a comparative advantage in violence, that extends over a particular geographic area, the boundaries of the state are determined by a power to tax constituents. So in a sense, they're kind of decreasing returns to scale to the size of states. So a state can be big, a state can be small. What's ultimately going to determine the size of the state is going to be its ability to extract resources, its ability to tax constituents. So that's the fundamental characteristic of the state. That's the fundamental thing that separates a state from any other form of organization. States use violence. Other organizations, other forms of organization do not. How is this relevant? Why is it important? And what might it have to do with some of the discussions that people are having right now about the different places that are being occupied by protesters who are angry about, the structure of modern American capitalism? Okay, so for North, again, he writes that a state is an organization with a comparative advantage in violence, extending over a geographic area whose boundaries are determined by its power to tax constituents. The state is going to be in a position to specify and enforce property rights. I'm going to dwell on that for just a second. A state can specify and enforce property rights. Now, there are a couple of different ways to think about property rights. We can think about property rights in a normative sense, and I'm obviously very sympathetic to that. I'm with Locke and I'm with Rothbard in that when one mixes one's labor with previously unowned resources, one is said to own it. Okay, but some of those property rights may not have traction if you can't actually defend them. So one could modify North's discussion by saying that a state is in a position to specify and enforce property rights, or a state is in a position to re-specify and enforce property rights, or a state is in a position to invade property rights and enforce new structures of rules, new institutions. essentially, a state can help us to decide who owns what and the circumstances under which they own it. Okay, so let's consider what North says about property rights. He says, and I quote, "The essence of property rights is the right to exclude, and an organization which has a comparative advantage in violence is in the position to specify and enforce property rights." So the state, as an organization with a comparative advantage in violence, is going to be in a position to specify and enforce property rights, to say who owns what and under what circumstances. And I'll offer a reading suggestion here. Robert Higgs, which is a name that some of you will find familiar, has a great article that was in a journal called Research in Economic History in the early 1980s, and it's collected in an edited volume, a volume edited by Lee Alston, Doug North, and Frown Egertson, called Institutions in, no, no, I think it's Empirical Studies in Institutional Change. But in any event, Higgs looks at the respecification of property rights in the Pacific salmon fishery, and I think this is the 19th century. And he points out how invasion of property rights by primarily white settlers whites who settled the territory led to, in fact, actually technological regress. So people started using inefficient technologies as a result of invasion and redistribution of property rights. For purposes of economic growth, the state's ability to specify who owns what and under what circumstances, and to enforce the rules that they choose to specify, well, this is going to have very, very important consequences. Very important consequences for economic growth, and very important consequences for the distribution of economic activity. There are two kinds of hierarchies. There are voluntary hierarchies and involuntary hierarchies. On Tuesday night, Peter talked about the theory and nature of the firm. And a firm is a voluntary hierarchy. Essentially, when people organize a firm, when people decide that they want to form a firm, they get together and they say, well, we're going to cede discretion to a manager. We're going to cede discretion to a board of directors. We're going to cede discretion to some sort of to somebody who's going to direct resources through some sort of channel that is not actually the price mechanism. Okay, so let's think about what that means for just a second. We know that markets are great. We know that markets and prices are essential if information is going to be aggregated, if information is going to be used, and if information is going to be deployed toward ends that we all find agreeable. But a lot of human organization is not mediated by the price mechanism. Families, the interaction between fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, mothers and sons, fathers and daughters, husbands and wives, generally not mediated by the price mechanism. The relationship between managers and subordinates in firms, also not mediated through the price mechanism. So Ronald Coase asked what a lot of people think is a very, very interesting question in his 1937 article on the nature of the firm, which is, well, if the price mechanism is so great and so wonderful, why is it that we organize ourselves into firms? Why do we forsake the price mechanism and organize ourselves in hierarchies where decisions are made on the basis of non-price considerations, when the price mechanism is presumably a very, very efficient and effective way to gather information and to see that information is deployed efficiently and effectively? His answer was transaction costs. So Coase's argument is that transaction costs explain the emergence of the firm. The existence of the firm economizes on transaction costs by substituting the discretion of a manager or the discretion of some sort of authority for the price mechanism itself. So on one hand, this might seem inefficient because, hey, prices are great and prices are wonderful, and prices help us to organize and deploy information. On the other hand, this can actually be a way that information is used more efficiently or that information is created more efficiently because, again, it's voluntary. The other type of hierarchy is an involuntary hierarchy, and this is the kind of hierarchy that's characterized by the state. there's a hierarchy that exists between governments and citizens. And the big difference between a government and a firm is, again, that a government can use violence. A state can use violence. A government can put you in jail, whereas a firm cannot. Okay? So there are going to be a couple of fundamental differences between voluntary and involuntary hierarchies. I'm going to speculate a little bit about what some of those are. So what is an information-creating hierarchy? So any hierarchy is going to circumvent the price mechanism or circumvent exchange and substitute in its place some sort of direction by a higher authority. In the case of a firm, that direction is direction by a manager of the actions of a subordinate. Firms, I'm going to argue, are information-creating hierarchies. Why is this the case? Because a firm in a capitalist society or a firm in a free market is bound, indeed duty-bound, by the goal of maximizing profits or the goal of creating shareholder value in the case of a corporation. So firms are going to organize themselves in such a way as to try to maximize profits, i.e., maximize the difference between the value of what is produced and the value of what is consumed in the process of production. So firms organize themselves in this way, or firms organize themselves in the way that they do in the service of this goal, in the service of profit maximization, and in the service ultimately of very, very, very clear signals that are sent by the market, specifically prices, profits, and losses. And in this sense, the hierarchy represented by a firm is going to be a hierarchy that ultimately creates information. How do we know that what kind of information is created? Well, if a firm earns profits, then this is the market's way of telling that firm that they're choosing wisely. If a firm is earning losses, this is the market's way of telling that firm that they're choosing poorly. If a firm is not maximizing profits, this is the market's way of telling them that, hey, there are other ways you could be doing things that would, in fact, increase your profits. What are those things? Well, you've got to figure those out for yourselves. But the hierarchy represented by a firm is fundamentally going to be an information-creating hierarchy that's going to help us figure out what the most effective and most efficient ways of doing things happen to be. Not so with a state. A state is an information-destroying hierarchy. Specifically, and again, this gets back to the fundamental difference between the firm and the state. What's the essence of the state? The essence of the state is the ability to use violence. Okay, what is violence? It's a threat of physical harm, specifically, ultimately, and in the limit, it's a threat that I will shoot you or I will kill you if you don't do what I tell you to do. It is not attempting to convince someone to do something. It's not getting someone to cooperate with you by offering to make their life easier or by offering to increase their set of possible choices. It's getting someone to cooperate with you by making their life harder or by offering to restrict their set of choices. Okay. And indeed, this is something Murray Rothbard pointed out in his 1956, I believe, article, Toward Reconstruction of Utility and Welfare Economics. He notes that any kind of coercive exchange, any kind of coercive cooperation, is one of the only things we can say about that is that for the person who is coerced, they're ultimately made worse off. So when we develop hierarchies using force, we step outside the market process. We step outside the ambit of exchange. We step outside prices. We step outside profits and losses. And therefore, we step outside of all of the information-generating processes and all of the information-generating mechanisms that would tell us whether we're choosing wisely or choosing poorly about how we're ultimately using our resources. So there are some similarities between firms and states in that both are hierarchical. But the fundamental difference is that states can use violence while firms cannot. Therefore, states are ultimately going to destroy information. They're ultimately going to destroy the feedback mechanisms that would tell us whether we're, again, using resources wisely or using resources poorly. And firms are going to be information revealing or information creating mechanisms that are going to tell us whether that they're going to help us figure out whether we're using resources wisely or using resources poorly. It's important to note that voluntary interaction creates value. If two people trade voluntarily, it's because they both expect to be better off. Involuntary interaction destroys value. If someone acquiesces to the demands of the state, if someone acquiesces to the demands of someone with a gun in his face, you know, we can infer from that that they prefer, they prefer acquiescence, they prefer following orders to whatever the consequences might be, which could be like a bullet in the head or something like that. But we don't know, or we can be reasonably certain, that that's not the path they would have chosen. Okay? We know that's not the path they would have chosen because force would not be necessary to get to make them a choice, or to get them to make a choice that would have ultimately made them better off. Okay. So let's think about the rationales for and the ultimate organization of the state. Okay, because so far we've painted a fairly dismal picture, so to speak, of the state itself. We painted a relatively rosy picture of the firm. Firms are information creating, firms are value creating, firms help to coordinate voluntary interactions that make people better off, so on and so forth. States destroy information and things like that. So why do we have states? It's a great question. Why do we have states? It's something that informed Doug North's research. It's something that informed Mises' research and Rothbard's research and my research and Peter's research to a certain extent. When we think about why we have states and how states are organized, there are a couple of different ways, a couple of different things we can say. Well, if you've taken an introductory economics class, a lot of times the way that we'll teach about the state will be to say that we have states in order to solve collective action problems, in order to fix market failures. There's a couple of different kinds of market failures. The first is called externalities. Externalities are spillover benefits or costs that spill over onto a third party who's not part of a transaction. So, for example, if I'm burning garbage in my yard and the smoke is causing asthma for people in my neighborhood, this would be an example of a spillover cost that presumably some type of state action might be necessary to correct. If I get a flu shot, then this is going to create spillover benefits because the people around me are going to be less likely to get the flu as a result of the fact that I've been vaccinated. So some sort of state action in the form of a subsidy or a mandate, according to this way of thinking, might actually be appropriate. Another kind of market failure is that markets are allegedly not going to produce public goods, things like national defense. So for example, if I buy defense from a nuclear missile attack in Memphis, there's no way for me to exclude my neighbor, my next door neighbor, from using that same nuclear missile defense. It's also non-rivalrous in that my consumption of defense does not reduce the amount that's available for my neighbor. At first cut, or so the argument goes, these are rationales for the development of a state because markets are going to overproduce goods that generate negative externalities. They're going to underproduce goods that produce positive externalities, and they might not produce at all public goods, things like national defense and what have you. So the argument is we need a state in order to deal with externalities. We need a state in order to provide public goods. Another argument for the state is that markets might tend toward monopoly. And monopolies are bad because they reduce social welfare. Monopolists produce too little output, and they charge too high a price. So they leave unproduced units of output that are worth more than they would cost to produce, and that would therefore make society better off if they were produced. So one thing that the government should, so presumably one thing the government should do, or that a state should do, is step in and prevent the emergence of monopolies through something like antitrust legislation or what have you. If markets tend toward monopolization, then they tend toward less consumer welfare, toward less social well-being than we would have in the event that we had perfect competition, we'll say. And therefore, the state is justified, or the reason that we have states is in order to deal with stuff like this. Okay, now first of all, this all sounds great. Okay, we have states to solve collective action problems, to deal with externalities, to provide public goods, to reduce the debt loss from monopoly. But historically, the state has in fact actually been the source of a lot of externalities. The state has been the source not of public goods, but of public bads. And the state is the reason that is primarily the main reason that monopolies exist in the first place. So historically, the alleged reasons why we have states are in fact the product of state action very, very generally. In the case of externalities, in a lot of cases, the reason why we have negative externalities or why we have positive externalities is because states that are allegedly tasked with specifying and defending private property rights don't in fact do that. Again, Rothbard has a great essay on this called Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution, in which he talks about how a strict liability system would deal with a lot of the alleged externality problems that we observe in the world today. So externalities are not necessarily, they're not cases of market failure, they're cases of government failure. Public goods. The case of national defense is a tough one. It's a very, very difficult one because, again, my consumption of national defense doesn't reduce the amount of national defense that is available for others. But firms generally don't fight wars. Walmart and Target, we're gonna talk about big box retail in our meeting a week from tonight. Walmart and Target don't actually fight each other with physical violence. Granted, there's an extent to which they do this by using government, but that's by proxy. When Walmart and Target are trying to compete with one another, they do so by lowering prices, by increasing output, by increasing quality. When McDonald's and Burger King are competing with one another, they do so by lowering prices, by increasing output, by increasing quality. If you're a fan of the website The Onion, they have some number of years ago, they had an article that was about the construction of a memorial to the veterans and the fallen heroes of the Cola Wars. So Coke versus Pepsi. This has been a knockdown, drag-out battle for decades and decades and decades and decades that has not spilled over into actual violence. The way that Coke and Pepsi compete with each other is by, again, lowering prices, increasing output, increasing quality. States, not so much. The way that states compete with each other generally is by shooting. States compete by engaging in war. So states, by their very nature, by their very existence, are generally going to be producers of public bads. And if you look at some of the things that the American government has done in the last, again, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 100, 200 and some odd years, it's not clear necessarily that these fit the public good definition of market failure. In fact, these might actually be public bads. And in the case, if you're familiar with the research of an economist named Brian Kaplan, he identifies a set of biases that motivate voters, one of which is anti-foreign bias. This suggests that people might actually be too quick to go to war relative to what they would actually prefer. So states are probably going to be generators of public bads when it comes to something like war. Now, what about monopoly? Another name that you might find familiar is Tom DiLorenzo. Look on YouTube or on Mises.org for some of his lectures on antitrust and the firm. And he talks about how specifically antitrust legislation has protectionist roots, or antitrust legislation exists to protect and monopolize, not to actually fight monopoly. I believe it was Alcoa, the aluminum company, in a decision that was set down in antitrust. A lot of the firms that were monopolizing were exhibiting exactly the opposite of monopolistic behavior. They were not raising prices and lowering output. They were increasing output and lowering prices. This is consistent with competition. It is not consistent with monopoly. What we observe from the state as it relates to monopoly is not reductions in monopoly, but rather increases in monopoly or the creation of monopoly power as such. So the rationale for the state that it's there to fix market failures like externalities like the provision of public goods, like the prevention of the emergence of monopoly, well, again, that's plausible to a first approximation, but ultimately I think it kind of falls apart on further analysis. The reality of the state is that it actually generates externalities. It provides not public goods, but public bads, and it actually creates monopolies instead of eliminating them. There are a couple of different ways that states are organized. States can be organized as democratic states. States can be organized as autocratic states. A lot of people think that democracy is great, and as decision-making mechanisms go, I'm kind of a fan of democracy, but it's not necessarily a cure for everything, it's not necessarily a cure for all social ills. Again, to reference Brian Kaplan's work on voter biases, given that people do have cognitive biases, given that people do have cultural biases, given that people have social biases, these are likely to be amplified through the political process. They're likely to be amplified in the voting booth, whereas they're more likely to be dampened in the marketplace. So consider, for example, the case of discrimination. Suppose that somebody's a bigot, and he or she does not like buying from people who look different, So suppose you've got blue people and green people, and you've got a blue guy and he doesn't like buying from green people. He faces a serious cost from indulging that bigotry, because he's not able to get products he would otherwise like. You know, it's going to hurt his bottom line if he's an employer and he refuses to hire green people. He's going to pay a price for his taste for discrimination, to borrow the term from Gary Becker. This isn't necessarily the case in the voting booth. He can vote for bigoted policies and externalize the cost onto everybody else. So everybody else pays the cost of someone's bigotry, while he gets to enjoy the benefit of casting a bigoted vote. So democratic systems ultimately and states are going to be likely to amplify social pathologies rather than eliminate them. In the case of autocracy, it's been argued that, well, you need a strong man in order to get economic freedom or in order to get good policies. And people will pull out the case of Chile or Singapore or South Korea as examples of situations in which you need an autocrat or you need a strong man in order to force through the policies that you really, really want. But in research by William Easterly, he's shown that, yeah, this is actually not systematic. Autocracy as such doesn't lead to or generally doesn't lead to the adoption of better policies, and the alleged benevolent autocrats that we observe, more than anything, this is probably not a function of autocracy as such, rather than of much deeper considerations. So do we need a state for economic growth? How should that state be organized? The answers are probably not, and I'm not really sure that it matters that much. Any kind of state organization is going to have fundamental problems because states as such use violence and stand in the way of commercial interactions and trade. There are two fundamentally different theories of where the state comes from or of how states ultimately emerge. The first is the contract theory of the state, and the second is the predatory theory of the state. According to the contract theory of the state, people choose to organize themselves into states, or they choose to grant authority. They choose to grant the ability to use force, the right to use force, to some type of central authority, because they need some type of enforcement mechanism in order to deal with these kinds of collective action problems with respect to, say, the provision of national defense, handling monopoly, internalizing externalities, and things of this nature. So states emerge ultimately as part of an organic process. People voluntarily create these hierarchies, and states are really just kind of like big firms. Okay, well, there's a sense in which states are firm-like, but again, historically, states have not necessarily emerged as a result of people getting together and saying, hey, we need to have a state because we have these massive collective action problems. The predatory theory of the state basically says that one group decides we are going to try to get as many goodies as we can from other people. We're going to go out and rob folks, and they try to increase our wealth that way. We're going to expropriate and redistribute rather than produce and exchange. So states emerge not as a result of people contracting to solve collective action problems. Rather, states emerge as a result of predatory processes whereby one group, a group perhaps with a comparative advantage in violence, threatens violence against others, and then is effectively able to extract tribute or extract protection money, and then emerges, and then ultimately emerges as a state. So where have states come from historically? I think primarily through predation rather than contract. What is the rationale for having states? Well, again, a first cut that you might learn in a basic economics class is to deal with externalities, public goods, and monopoly. Not really clear that that washes necessarily. How are states organized? Well, they're organized in a bunch of different ways. Are they fundamentally necessary? Again, the work that I've done, the work that some of you might be familiar with, suggests that in fact they are. Maybe not totally superfluous, but at the very least, it's not entirely clear that states are necessary for long-run economic growth. What's big government? What is big government, and what can we ultimately say about it? Measuring the state historically is very difficult. There are a couple of different ways to think about the size of the government. Or the size of, and let's just use the American government as an example. We can think about the absolute budget of the government, so the number of trillions of dollars that the government is spending as a size, as a measure of bigness. But another way to think about the state might be to compare the state's expenditures to the total size of the economy. So what are government expenditures as a percentage of GDP? Or what are government expenditures as a percentage of total income? These, while they might be useful, are not going to fully capture the relevance of the state to people's day-to-day activities. Ultimately, what matters is not necessarily the state's ability to spend money, but the state's ability to use violence, the state's ability to restrict people's choices via the threat of coercion. And they can do this in a couple of different ways. If they have ultimate power, if they have the ability to force people to do things, then they might be incredibly powerful, even though they're not spending a lot of money. So another measure of state size might be the number of pages in the Federal Register. And this is one way that people have come up with, that they've tried to measure the size of government. They've tried to measure the size of the American state. And again, historically, states may not necessarily have spent a lot of money. They may not have been able to tax necessarily, but they've been able to conscript, or they've been able to direct via centralized mechanisms the activities of those who are under their authority or those who are under their control. So when we talk about the rise of big government, it's not necessarily clear that we have a very precise measure of what we mean by the bigness of government or by the bigness of the state. What we really want to do is try to find some sort of measure of the state's power, the state's ability to use force. In some cases, that's going to be the state's actual tax revenue. In other cases, that's going to be the state's ability to force people into the military or something to that effect. So let's consider just one example of changes in state power. If people say that the government has gotten larger in the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and indeed there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's the case. But the government's authority has changed, and has changed dramatically. For example, I hope that my son doesn't grow up facing a military draft. I didn't face a military draft. The state no longer has the legitimate authority to do that. So in this sense, the state might be spending more money, might be taking a bigger chunk of my income, but I don't face the prospect of being forced into the military. And this again is something that is a bit of a change relative to most of history, and indeed relative to the entirety of the American experience. We talk about whether people are more free or less free than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. Yeah, the government in the 19th century, the federal government might not have spent much money. State governments might not have spent much money, but they were massive invaders of liberty. The most conspicuous example being in the early part of the 19th century, slavery in the American South. And then through the rest of the 19th century and the early 20th century, Jim Crow and various legal restrictions on the rights of African Americans. So yes, the government might be spending more money today, but it is exercising less authority in the form of things like Jim Crow laws or protections on slavery as they had in the early 19th century. So yeah, the government might be a little bit bigger today than it was. On some margins, it might be smaller on others. It might have less discretion on others. And if we're going to think about the state as an actor in economic history, we need to be very, very clear about specifying the precise margins on which state action takes place and the precise margins on which we're really thinking about state activity. Now, the main relevance of the state as an actor in economic history is that it is a provider of economic institutions. So what are institutions? According to Norris, institutions had three characteristics. Institutions were formal rules, specifically laws, thou shalt and thou shalt not, specified by the state. Informal norms, which were evolved, these were cultural constraints, thou shalt and thou shalt not, that were determined by mechanisms of cultural selection, and enforcement characteristics. So basically the rules of the game are in some senses provided by states, and these comprise a society's set of institutions to which organizations, states, firms, nonprofits, the Mises Institute, etc., respond. These are going, people are ultimately going to be responding to the incentives that are in place as a result of the institutions that are specified in some cases by the state. Over the long run, if we're interested in economic growth, one of the major changes that has happened in the last 2.5 centuries has been a big switch in incentives. For most of the human experience, the way to get rich was expropriation and redistribution. It was to take things that don't belong to you and to use them for yourself. It was, in other words, to use violence, to use coercion, to use the threat that you're going to limit other people's options, that you're going to make life harder for them, in order to get them to make life easier for you and to expand your range of options. For the better part of human history, we've existed in large part as a result of the institutions that were in place in a zero-sum society where people were fighting over redistribution of real resources. Things started to change in the 18th century. We were able to get the cultural institutions right. We were able to get, to a certain extent, the political institutions and the formal institutions, not right necessarily, but far better than they used to be. And people started to have incentives to produce and exchange, to make themselves better off by offering to make other people better off, to expand their own options by offering to expand other people's options. And ultimately, we're off to the races, and we have all the great, wonderful wealth that we observe today in large parts of the rich Western world. This is of fundamental importance, because one of the things that's motivating the Occupy Wall Street protests is this alleged tension between the 1% and the 99%, or between the very, very wealthy and the rest of us, those of us who are not very, very wealthy. If inequalities in the distribution of income and inequalities in the distribution of wealth are the result of production and exchange, then I see no reason necessarily to criticize those. You know, if Steve Jobs gets rich because he invents products that make us all better off, things like iPhones, then there's no reason necessarily, I think, to criticize Steve Jobs. If Steve Jobs gets wealthy by stealing things from other people, then yeah, we should criticize Steve Jobs. I'm not going to venture into intellectual property here, which was something that helped to make Steve Jobs very, very wealthy. But for the most part, people like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Sam Walton, and others made themselves incredibly wealthy via production and exchange rather than expropriation and redistribution. When we're dealing with the state, and when we're talking about the effect of the state on economic growth, and when we're talking about the effect of the state on society at large, we want to think about the kinds of incentives that emerge from state action. One of the major intellectual revolutions that has taken place in the last 50, 60 years has been the public choice revolution in economics. And this is the application of basic economic logic. People act. People are essentially rational. People respond to incentives. People pursue their own self-interest to political decision-making. You might have heard the term rent-seeking, which is kind of an unfortunate term to describe what it ultimately describes. But this is basically the process of trying to get rich through expropriation and redistribution, through using the state to get privileges and favors to prevent other people from competing with you and to make yourself rich, not by expanding other people's options, not by producing new wealth, not by trading, but by redistributing things from other people to you. The essence of the state and the essence of state activity is to encourage rent-seeking activity. So let's think about some of the criticisms that the Occupy movement, or that members of the Occupy movement have sort of leveled at modern government, at modern capitalism, at modern firms. So according to some people, what we've observed is the creation of this beautiful institution, this beautiful idea, which is democratic government, that's been corrupted by special interests, or that's been corrupted by large firms, that's been corrupted by massive capitalists. I think that's there's a sense in which that might possibly be true, that yes, in fact, powerful special interests are corrupting the state itself. But I think the arrow of the direct of causality runs I think the causation runs in the other direction. What's been corrupted is not the state by commerce, but rather commerce by the state. There's a virtue to voluntary exchange because it creates wealth, because it's voluntary, because it respects the simple dignity of the human person. There's an absence of virtue, I think, to expropriation and redistribution because it doesn't respect the simple dignity of the human of the human person. The fundamental problem with the state, the fundamental problem with the development of the state, is that it encourages rent seeking. It encourages people, if we're all self-interested, to go and try to get wealthy at the expense of others by seeking special privileges, by seeking things like licensing restrictions on, say, the economics profession. I might go out and lobby for licensing restrictions to say, okay, you have to fulfill a certain number of criteria in order to call yourself an economist. And clearly, that'd be purely a matter of public interest rather than self-interest. It would be to protect people from charlatans, but there'd be a very agreeable byproduct of that, in that that would probably raise my income and raise it substantially if I could prevent people from competing with me. The state, and at its very essence, by virtue of the fact that it makes violence available to people who are self-interested, encourages not production and exchange, but expropriation and redistribution. Things have been out of hand for the better part of the human experience, and it's only been in the last couple of centuries that the rent-seeking society has been restricted to the point that, for a lot of people, it's in fact actually more profitable and more remunerative to produce and trade rather than to expropriate and redistribute. And so what we're observing, I think, today is not the corruption of democracy by commerce, but the corruption of commerce by the state itself. This may all be well and true, but one fallback in these kinds of discussions is that some people say, well, okay, yeah, but what kind of society do we want to create? What kind of society do we want to create? Do we want to create a society in which people are getting wealthy, or in which people are trading, or do we want to create a society in which people are helping each other, and where people are engaged in some kind of collective action toward a common goal? Often, this is not so much a discussion of social institutions, the utility of social institutions, and the effect of social institutions on the production and distribution of wealth, so much as it's a signal that you're the kind of person who cares about the poor, or you're the kind of person who cares about the historically marginalized, or the kind of person who cares about the lower classes, or the kind of person who cares about whatever, fill in the blank with with someone that you might want to care about. Economics, it's argued, is a dismal science, in part because it kind of rains on people's parades. You know, it rains on people's proposals to have minimum wages, or people's proposals to restrict foreign commerce, people's proposals to try to make everybody better off by engaging in this or that in this or that intervention. I don't really think economics is dismal for that reason. I think economics is in fact liberating, because it shows us what is ultimately possible if we reduce people's incentives to expropriate and redistribute, and increase people's incentives to produce an exchange. In the case of the Occupy Wall Street movement, people are telling very, very, what I think are very, very simple stories about good guys, you know, the politicians I like, and bad guys, which is the politicians I don't like, plus corporations. But I think reality is a lot more subtle, and reality is not nearly that simple. Tyler Cowen has a great talk that he gave recently on the difference on telling good versus evil stories in explanations of social phenomena. And I think when we're talking about the development of the state, when we're talking about some of the things that the Occupy movement is discussing, stories about good versus evil, or stories about good guys versus bad guys, should ultimately be a last resort. We should be looking to the kinds of incentives that people are responding to, and the kinds of incentives that people are facing, and the sources of those incentives over time, and only get to, well, bad things are happening because bad people want bad things to happen, or good things happen because good people want good things to happen, if we've exhausted all other possible explanations. What's the role of economics in all of this? If you took my capitalism and socialism class, or if you've read, in fact, I can't remember if I've written about this or not, someday I want to write a book called The Possibility of Civilization that will be about the role of the economic way of thinking in fact, guarding the possibility of civilization. Ironically, it was Keynes himself who once gave a toast to the economists, who are the trustees, not of civilization, but of the possibility of civilization. And indeed, when we're thinking hard about the fact that people respond to incentives, when we're thinking hard about the fact that people generally pursue their own self-interest, this leads us to what I think is a different set of conclusions than, say, a lot of members of the Occupy Wall Street movement are reaching. I think that the way that we need to proceed is not to say, how has the state been corrupted? What can we do to prevent the state from being corrupted further by special interests? But do we even need a state to begin with? Is the state a guarantor of civilization, or is it ultimately an affront to civilization? What can the economic way of thinking tell us ultimately? And I think we get when we're very, very careful about the economics, a very, very different picture than a lot of people in the Occupy Wall Street movement are trying to paint. So there are a handful of really good resources on this that I would encourage you to consult after we're finished. I listed two here, and I mentioned a couple of others. Doug, if you could put this on the Moodle page, that'd be wonderful. Again, Tyler Cowen gives a great TED talk on stories and how stories sometimes influence us for good or for bad in our understanding of social phenomena. Murray Rothbard, in a collection of essays that he has called Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature, has an excellent little article called The Anatomy of the State that talks about the history and development of the state. Rothbard also has an article that I mentioned earlier, Toward a Reconstruction of Utility and Welfare Economics, that helps us to figure out how we can tell whether different sets of social institutions are making people better off or making people worse off. And he also has, again, a discussion in his article, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, good Lord, that's a three-volume work by Hayek, Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution. All this stuff is available, I believe, on Mises.org, in which he explains how state action to deal with environmental problems or to deal with conflicts over property rights might itself actually be superfluous. So when we're thinking about the nature of the state, I think in looking at different theories of how the state has emerged historically and why we have it, some people espouse a contract theory of the state, where we decide to have a state because it helps us solve collective action problems, and some people espouse a predatory theory of the state, where we have states because some people with a comparative advantage in violence are able to use that violence in order to enrich themselves at others' expense. I think ultimately states are fundamentally predatory, and I think that while I agree with the Occupy Wall Street movement that the game is being rigged in favor of powerful special interests, I don't think it's a question of reclaiming democracy from large corporations, but rather reclaiming civil society, reclaiming civilization from the state, and reclaiming civilization from the use of force. So the slides are available on the Moodle site. I'm going to open up the chat window here, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you guys might have for, say, the next 30 minutes or so. Peter, I know, has been passed a microphone. If you want to jump in and say anything, or if you have any questions or any answers, feel free to dive in. Okay, so here we go. So we have a chat window. We've got Q&A. Okay, so Q&A. Let's see, question from Jim Chapelow. Does the use of force really distinguish the voluntary from involuntary hierarchies? Okay, what about the use of force when parents discipline children or rent a cop to detain shoplifters? Isn't the possibility of exit more important in distinguishing the two? Okay, yeah, that's actually okay. So in my Q&A, that's a great question. Does the use of force really distinguish the voluntary from involuntary hierarchies? Okay, it's entering into the hierarchy. Excuse me. It's whether you enter into a hierarchy voluntarily or involuntarily. I think that's where the use of force is most relevant. Use of force when parents discipline children. Okay, so forgive me. I think I've caught something from my own kids. I'm going to avoid discussing the family right now because children are kind of a special case. I'm going to deal primarily with contracts among adults. In the case of rent-a-cops detaining shoplifters, what happens when someone tries to shoplift at Target or Walmart or somewhere like that is what they're doing is they're violating a contract. And force in this case comes in. Force in this case is used to make good on contracts or to punish people who are defecting in the case of an organization. Okay, so that, let me back up on this just a second, because I don't really think that was clear. So let's think about hierarchies. Okay, I'm thinking about hierarchies and organizations specifically. States or societies are organizations that can be arranged hierarchically and that are ultimately based on the use of force. So my membership in the United States of America, my membership in the city of Tennessee, my membership in the city of Memphis, you know, these are all based on their ability to use force to extract taxes from me. My employment at Rhodes College is voluntary. My work with the Mises Institute is also voluntary. So in the case of hierarchies very narrowly, voluntary versus involuntary, I do think that the use of force is what's ultimately relevant. Things get a little bit more subtle when you're talking about voluntary and involuntary exchange. The possibility of exit is something that's more important. I would agree that that's probably what's more important in distinguishing the relationship between a citizen and the government versus the relationship between a firm and a customer. But ultimately, the possibility of exit is going to be determined by one's ability to use force. Okay, so let's see. Doug is changing the Moodle page, which is great. Okay, additional questions? Okay, from Benjamin, from Benjamin. Name of the video: Antitrust. I think Antitrust and Monopoly. Just look up Tom DiLorenzo on the Mises video, in the Mises audio and video archives, or on YouTube. I think Antitrust and Monopoly, I believe, is the name of his lecture. Okay, let's see here. Okay, James Key. I'm not an expert on poli-sci, but is it the first or maybe a primary purpose of the state to protect life and property? Your discussion of the state sounds pretty dismal, but preventing violence of citizen against citizen is rather key. Okay, yeah, it is, and indeed, some states are much better at it than others. Some states are pretty good at protecting some people from violence, and other states are pretty bad at it. So on the continuum of states from perfectly perfectly imperfect, countries like the U.S., like the United Kingdom, like a lot of European countries, are pretty good at preventing violence, and a lot of other countries are not so much. The first or maybe primary purpose of a state is to protect life and property. There's an argument that is the case, and one of the reasons why a state might protect life and property is to conserve its assets, and it views its taxpaying citizens as assets. Indeed, there's a story named Margaret Levy, she's a political scientist actually, one of North's former colleagues at the University of Washington, and someone from whom North draws a lot, has a book that I've unfortunately not read that's called Of Rule and Revenue. It's on my bookshelf. It's definitely on my readme list. But Levy and a lot of others argue that states are motivated by the desire to maximize revenue, and they're going to prevent violence and protect property in order to ultimately maximize the value maximize the net present value of their future stream of tax extractions. Okay, other questions? To get back to Jim's question, I think he's distinguishing between what some people might call the legitimate and the illegitimate use of force. To punish someone who has invaded property rights or who has aggressed against property rights, and a shoplifter is someone who's aggressed against property rights, that I would argue, and I think Rothbard would as well, and I'm sure Peter would, that is a legitimate use of force. To initiate force, to tax somebody, is an illegitimate use of force.
Art, I might, if I could just add a quick word.
Oh, right ahead.
I mean, there's also, you know, it's useful to distinguish between the kind of ostensible role of the state and the de facto role of the state. You know, mostly what Art's been talking about is what states in fact do, and what we think historically the role of the state has been, how the state has emerged, and so forth. One can certainly make an argument that the state should do X, Y, or Z, or that we ought to have a state to perform function X or Y. That's a different matter from talking about what states, you know, in fact do. And then one would also want to address, you know, if we think the state, there should be a state to perform a particular set of functions, then we want to do some comparative institutional analysis and see if in fact there are other non-state institutions that might be able to perform that same function in a way that doesn't involve, you know, the monopoly on coercion and the aspects of the state that we would consider to be problematic.
Yeah. You're exactly right. Those are very, very good points. Comparing the ostensible role of the state to the de facto role of the state is I think the That's the most important question in comparative political economy that people are asking right now, is what do states actually do to say, well, we need a government in order to fight monopoly. Well, again, historically, states have been the source of monopoly, not the source of competition. Again, thinking about what they actually do, my own view of the state, my own my development of honestly, anarchism has been not due to an idea that market will always be perfect and produce utopia, or that states are always and everywhere evil. It's fundamentally rooted in the tradition of Mises and Hayek of comparative political economy, where what they ultimately show, what Mises and Hayek show in the economic calculation debate, and this I think is buttressed by the contributions of James Buchanan, Gordon Tullock, and scholars working in the public choice tradition, is even under the best of circumstances, governments can't do the things that we would like for governments to do, or governments can't do the things that we say governments should do. Even if we say, well, we should have a government in order to prevent the emergence of monopoly, again, you know, there might be a story to be told about that, but it's the creation of the use of force as such that is problematic. Force is going to accrue to those who are most willing to use it. Force is going to accrue to those who value it most highly. And as Gordon Tullock shows in some of his research, often what's going to happen is that the actual value of what is being transferred will be frittered away in the process of people competing with one another through the political process to get the transfers. So if you look around, another name some of you might find familiar, Michael Munger, is a political scientist at Duke University and an economist, frequent guest on Econ Talk, and has a couple of really, really interesting articles, or a really interesting article on the Library of Economics and Liberty about rent seeking, and a great Econ Talk podcast about rent seeking that I would encourage you all to check out. I remember in a seminar I was at, which Munger was presenting, he said every time someone says the government should do this, they should replace the government with politicians who are actually likely to be elected. And this, I think, gives us a totally different set of propositions about what the government does, about what the government can do, what the government should do, or what policies are or are not wise. So I would encourage you. to look up what Munger has to say, and then if you're ever in D.C. or in the D.C. area, I'm always very conflicted by this because I spent a little bit of time, you know, in D.C. And so you walk around cities in the D.C. area like Arlington, Virginia, Crystal City, or Boston, or some of these places in Metro D.C. A lot of nice restaurants and sort of well put together infrastructure, nice buildings and things like that. And you realize that almost all of this represents political competition, not competition to make people's lives better by increasing their opportunities, but competition to make people's lives worse by restricting their opportunities, or competition whereby people are trying to get rich not by helping other people, but at other people's expense. Okay, great, excellent. So Doug is putting in real time is putting Munger on Moodle page, which is great.
Hey Art, comment on Rudy's question. I'm not sure, Rudy, if this is what you're getting at, but Robert Nozick famously argued that if you had a state of anarchy with private organizations providing dispute resolution and protection against force from citizen against citizen, private protection agencies, that there would be a tendency for them to expand and grow and form alliances, and there would eventually emerge a sort of cartel of these agencies just on the market, which would become de facto a state and could be renamed a state, just as you state, as you say in your question. And I'm not sure if you're getting at the Nozick argument. Tyler Cowen had a paper back in the late 80s or early 90s that made this argument as well. And I think one of the useful ways to think about this is, if we think about the nature of competition, do we think that it's possible that organizations competing with each other could in fact form a kind of monopoly on the free market, whether it's protection agencies or automobile companies or anything else? And I think one of the articles that I mentioned on Tuesday, Murray Rothbard's argument that I summarize in my article on the limits to the firm, suggests that on a purely free market, There is a limit to how large any organization or group of organizations can become because of the problem of economic calculation, as pointed out by Mises. So I would tend to think that there are natural market limits that are brought about by the nature of competition among organizations that would prevent the emergence of a de facto state from a state of anarchy, as Nozick described it.
Yeah, I would agree with Peter on that there are de facto limits on the growth of organizations and the ability of states to emerge out of a situation of anarchy. Now, my guess would be that in the short run you would get state-like organizations, the mafias and whatnot, that would be able to extract protection money over the short run, that would be able to coerce over the short run. But one of the beautiful things about a free market is entry. And granted, entry might be very, very difficult. It might be hard to compete with the Corleone family if they're trying to establish themselves as a small state. But ultimately, it can be done. I think that cartels would be very, very difficult to maintain in the protection industry, just as they're difficult to maintain in a lot of other industries. Now, one thing that I think is an open question, and this is a discussion I have with students sometimes, is what is the role of ideology in all of this? So why is it that states are able to maintain themselves? Why are states able to grow the way that they do? And why don't states ultimately and fundamentally collapse? And I think there's an underexplored area in comparative political economy and this intersection of the economics of institutions with the Austrian tradition is the role of ideology in maintaining states, maintaining the use of force and the use of violence as something that people perceive as legit. Robert Higgs has done a lot of great work on this, but I think we're only sort of scratching the surface on what on how ideology matters for the determination of economic and political institutions. Peter again.
Oh yeah, I mean I agree with that. I was going to make that point as well. That I mean, Art has been emphasizing the economic nature of the state, and rightly so. But you know, the point is, you know, difference between the state conventionally defined and, you know, a large private organization that performs some state-like functions is partly this, this sort of set of beliefs, right? I mean, the state claims a certain legitimacy. It claims to be a different kind of entity. It's not just another organization. It's not one, it's not an organization seeking its own goals. You know, it's us. It is the representation of us. It's designed to make us better off. Citizens have a particular duty of loyalty to obey the state and its mandates. You know, the Corleone family, they may have, demanded protection money from the people, in their region of New York or whatever, but there was no pretense that this was anything other than, you know, racketeering. There wasn't an ideology that said, oh, the Corleones are, you know, that they embody the people and everyone must love the Corleone family and so on. I mean, in a sense, that's one of the good things about, you know, mafia organizations compared to government racketeers, is that the mafia doesn't pretend that it's doing you a favor after they beat you over the head, you know, and grab your stuff. Whereas when a state agent does something like that, you know, kills you in a drone strike or whatever, that they also, you know, you're supposed to say thank you so much, you know, for killing my neighbor or shooting my kids or whatever, because, you know, you're right, this sort of super legitimate organization. And so, for a complete, well-rounded understanding of what the state does and how it works, of course we want to consider this ideological element too.
Yeah, so there are a couple of really good questions that have come up. One, I'll try to get these taken care of in short order. So James Key asks about Somalia. Says, and I quote, "So Somalia sounds like a paradise. No state-sponsored monopolies and very little state violence against citizens." Okay, so that's a fair objection. So, well, One thing that I found interesting about the last 4 or 5 years has been the degree to which left and right have almost switched sides, where the left has become the America love or leave it side of the argument, and the right has become the dissent as the highest form of patriotism side of the argument. I've been told, you know, if you hate government so much, move to Somalia, or if you'll cap freedom so much, move to Somalia a couple of times. There's a lot of really, really good work now on Somali anarchy. And no, I don't want to live in Somalia. Somalia's problems are not because they don't have a state. This goes far, way farther back into the relevant difference is not just having a state versus not having a state, but people who are studying this issue. So Peter Leeson at George Mason University and Benjamin Powell has a couple of great articles on this. Okay, yeah, Peter Klein to all participants. See Ben Powell's work on Somalia. Compared to other countries in the region, Somalia is actually doing pretty well. And yes, that's exactly right. If you compare Somalia to its neighbors with states, it turns out, Somalia is experiencing better growth. It's experiencing, I can't remember off the top of my head, but most indicators of social well-being, Somalia is actually has been doing better than its neighbors that have states. So I don't want to move to Somalia, but at the margin, the absence of a state does not appear to be reducing Somali economic growth or Somali social progress to the extent that it exists, relative, again, to a relevant comparison group. Okay, let's see here. Again, I'm going to try to get these in order. So we've got, so Matthew Tomko, in a book called The Quest for Community, has argued that the growth of the modern state was primarily due to the fact that traditional forms of community have declined in importance, and given that people seem to need to participate in a form of community, they now gravitate toward worship of the state. Do you believe this argument can be addressed by the economic ideas against the state you brought up? That's a good question. So why are traditional forms of community declining? So one could argue that changes in the infrastructure of national and international trade might be one of the reasons why people are doing that. I've done a little bit of work on social capital, especially as it relates to Walmart. And we'll talk about that again a week from tonight. So you mentioned worship, and I find that to be really, really interesting. And there's a great book that I would recommend. It's by a guy named Gregory Boyd called The Myth of a Christian Nation. And Doug knows about this book. It talks about something that I, as a Christian with an evangelical background, have noticed that I found a little bit disconcerting is the amount of the degree to which people try to wrap religion in the flag, or the degree to which people try to wrap Christianity in the American flag. And I think this is a very, very important part of what's going on. And in this sense, sort of a lot of criticisms of modernity see a very, very tight nexus between the state and faith that is not necessarily an accident. I think part of it is, there are parts of it that are deliberate. Part of it, I think, for whatever reason, we have an innate attraction to, or an innate desire to see something bigger than ourselves. And for a lot of people, it's the state that does that. But the ritual of state-sanctioned and state-created holidays is one of the things that ultimately keeps us going. Let's see here. Mike Friedland, regarding points on ideology, which might be the stronger argument, the state should be limited because there's intrinsic value in the liberty of the individual, or two, the state should be limited because to do so provides an enhancement to prosperity. Okay, that's a great question. In terms of strategy for liberty, or in terms of the kinds of discussions that people ultimately have. When push comes to shove, when we get down to brass tacks, and when you employ every cliche imaginable, I'm of the view that coercion is fundamentally wrong. Is that liberty is intrinsically valuable? That coercion is an affront to what it means to be human. But I think that arguments like number two are able to do most of the heavy lifting on things like this. The state should be limited because to do so provides an enhancement to prosperity, because the kind of discussion that you might find yourself in, if you're pushing the first thing, is the liberty of the individual, liberty of the individual, the obvious objection people say is, well, what about the poor? Well, what about the poor? Okay, look, I care about the poor. You care about the poor. Let's all care about the poor. I think, easier and ultimately sort of leads us down the road toward more liberty to pursue sort of the second line of argument and say, well, the state should be limited because to do so provides an enhancement to prosperity, because most of the stuff that is enacted in the name of the poor is in fact detrimental to the interests of the poor. Minimum wages create unemployment, price controls create shortages, restrictions on international trade make everybody poor, so on and so on and so on. So, to summarize, most of the offered exceptions to, number one, the state should be limited because there's intrinsic value in the liberty of the individual, some people would say, well, we have to restrict liberty. We have to have a state because, you know, we don't want people to starve to death or what have you. We have these great humanitarian goals. Well, in fact, actually, the introduction of coercion often works to produce the precise opposite of what the advocate of coercion seeks to obtain. So, long story short, I think that consequentialist arguments like number two do most of the heavy lifting in a lot of these cases. Let's see here. Okay, how can it be unlikely that a state would emerge from anarchy? Must it not be the case that the state either evolved from a primordial anarchy through human history, or that the state has always been around? Okay, so that's a good question. That's a very good question about origins, and quite honestly, I am not sure how to answer.
Art, could I take a stab at it?
Peter's going to take a stab at it, right?
Just because I like to deal with this particular questioner. Okay. I mean, Jim, I think it depends to some degree what we mean by anarchy in this context. That I don't think anyone is claiming that there was some kind of, you know, anarcho-capitalist society based on voluntary exchange and consent and respect for person and property out of which the first states emerged. I mean, anthropologically, you know, you could imagine that the earliest human relationships could very well have been coercive, right? That of, you know, domination of one party by another through the use of force, and the idea of voluntary contractual relations and, you know, respect for property and exchange and so on emerged later, right? So the claim isn't that states, you know, the relationship of coercion emerged out of some prior historical period in which relationships were based on consent and cooperation. That isn't necessarily the case at all. So so there's no, you know, the claim that you make is no one is claiming that there was a state of anarchy out of which some sort of states emerged, and that therefore that would be a counter to the kind of, you know, arguments that we're making against Nozick and so on. Let me know if that makes sense.
Wow. Excellent answer. One of the reasons I enjoy doing this, and one of the reasons that I was excited about doing this course with Peter is I've been sort of an informal student of Peter's for a number of years at various Mises Institute events, and a lot of what I know about the nature of the firm comes from suggested readings from listening to some of Peter's lectures and things like that. So that's a very, 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 very good point.
Well, I didn't know that, Art. I wish I had some way to monetize that relationship. But.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that later, I guess. Let's see here. Well, okay, in a sense, it's already been monetized, but we will talk about it later. Okay, Rise and Fall Society. Let's see here. Okay, Rudy again asks about Nietzsche's theory of the eternal return. Forgive me, I've not read much Nietzsche, so I'm not. So again, I'm not going to be equipped to answer that one. let's see, Peter, if you want to, you can take a stab at it, or I will move on and see if anyone has other questions.
No, I don't have a stab, but I'm just remembering an administrative note that I myself had forgotten. That Art, you and I need to remember that only we can see the questions, but students can't see the questions of other students. So we need to be sure, and we need to repeat the question before we answer. That's my comment.
Okay. Good point. Okay.
I mean, just since it's coming up on 7:30, or rather 8:30 Eastern, I just want to make one brief remark. The questions being asked about the nature of anarchy, the nature of do states emerge out of anarchy, and so on. I mean, these are great questions. These are extremely important issues. They're very interesting to discuss. But I don't think that the basic points that we're making in the course are particularly, are dependent on a very specific set of answers to some of those questions. You know, what we're trying to point out in Tuesday's lecture and today's, it's just some basic ideas about, what is the nature of voluntary exchange, what is the nature of for-profit market-like institutions, and how do those differ from, state institutions where the state is defined as, the entity with the legal monopoly on use of coercion. You know, we just want to emphasize important differences, comparison and contrast between these two kinds of institutions, things like, what we assume that voluntary exchange is mutually beneficial ex ante, but we simply don't know from a sort of a priori point of view whether coerced exchange, we know that it benefits one party, but we can't say unambiguously that it benefits both parties. The nature of entrepreneurship in market-based exchange is value creating, whereas political entrepreneurship, entrepreneurship by the state, it's much more ambiguous, right? We don't have a way to measure benefits and costs in dollars because the the goods and services produced by the state are not sold on the market. So we can't calculate, we can't measure, we can't value the same way that we can with private actors. Private market entrepreneurs have a pretty, in most cases, a sort of unambiguous objective function. They want to earn profit, right? They want to earn revenues in excess of their costs. Political actors have a much more complicated set of objectives. Measuring performance is much more difficult. We don't have the same kind of, evolutionary selection mechanism using profit and loss to say that, the more effective political actors will rise to the top and so forth. So we just want to lay out some general differences between the nature of, the firm, the nature of private business action, and the nature of the state, to set up the really exciting stuff we'll get into next week about, whether big business is good or bad for society. And of course, there are a lot of extremely interesting and deep and challenging questions associated with this topic, but we're not trying to convince you to take any particular position on those really difficult questions. Art, is that a fair summary?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and these are fascinating because in the case of these questions about anarchy, I mean, these are like frontline questions in the social sciences. In some cases, things to which we don't ultimately have answers. And so forgive me if I've gotten a little bit far afield of these differences between the firm and the state, where you have information creating and information destroying hierarchies. but there's a lot of work to be done, and I think a lot of great reading to be done. There's a lot of great reading you can do, and I think a lot of great work to be done. Exploring these differences between voluntary and involuntary hierarchies. In fact, I remember my mentor John Nye, when I was in graduate school, saying I think he proposed that he wanted to write a book someday called Hierarchies, in which he explored specifically this: where does the firm end and the state begin, or where does voluntary exchange end and involuntary exchange begin? I will take one more quick question, if someone has it, and then we'll dismiss until Tuesday. Okay. Well, with that, I don't have any other questions. So we will pick up again with Peter on Tuesday night, talking about the relationship specifically between business and government. And then I will pick up next Thursday. We'll talk about retail specifically, and we'll put a little bit more empirical flesh on some of these theoretical bones. So thank you all for your time, your energy, and your attention. If you have any questions, shoot me an email. We can make an appointment to meet on Skype, on Facebook, on Google Video, on what have you. And look forward to chatting with you again on Tuesday.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Peter.